Yes, welcome back to the show here on World Football Daily, an absolutely mammoth weekend in the Premier League. As always, we're getting down to squeaky bum time, as they say, in for the Premier League relegation race. Joining us to have a look at everything that took place this weekend is the man who we always love to get on the show to talk English football. It's Christian Hennage joining us today. Christian, how are you, mate?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm glad you're doing well. Are you surprised about everything that's going on in your neck of the woods at the moment, considering that Saturday we have Martin O'Neill going, leaving Sunderland, and by Monday morning we have what everybody thinks is an April Fool's joke, Paolo Di Canio taking charge of the Black Cats?
It's a funny one. I mean, he didn't seem somber. I mean, he seemed quite melancholic in his press conference on Saturday afternoon, and I guess you could argue with hindsight that that was probably a sign that things were coming to a close, because if he's not at one end of the emotional spectrum, then you need to worry about Martin O'Neill. I think that you're right, the appointment of Di Canio is a surprising one, if only for the repercussions we've seen already with the politician David Miliband stepping out, or former politician, I should say.
It's not very often that you get politics and football so closely intertwined, but it seems like a lot of people, aside from David Miliband, are forgetting Di Canio's very extreme political views, shall we put it that way. What's been the reaction up in Sunderland to this appointment?
I think, to be fair, and it could be because of their partisan views towards Sunderland, the fans have tried to take it with partly a pinch of salt, but also give credence to both sides of that story. Now, as I say, there are two very healthy sides to that story, and probably a third one as well. There is the view that, you know, he's a fascist, and because of that, you know, I'm trying to think of a polite way to say this, has a very extreme views. There are others who say that realistically he's been misquoted, and that when he says he's a fascist, he means that he agrees with certain aspects of the fascist ideology that possibly weren't as prevalent as those that we now consider the worst aspects of it. I would probably side with the second one. I don't think he's as fervent a fascist as some people are making out. I think that there are certain aspects of that ideology that he adheres to and thinks that could be beneficial to society. But again, as he said, I'm not a racist, I'm a fascist. It's that soundbite that, because it's someone like Di Canio, it travels far quicker than if he actually explained himself to a good degree.
What about on the pitch? Di Canio's only got League One, League Two experience in England. Is he a man that people believe can get Sunderland out of this horrible slide that looks like it's going to send them down into the relegation zone inside the next few weeks?
Well, the thing is, he's been billed, as you could argue, in the same mould as Martin O'Neill, someone who's going to motivate, you know, provide kicks up to backsides and such like. But from my experience with him at Swindon, he's incredibly meticulous. He is someone who does, you know, find devil in the detail and likes to focus on every aspect of his side. And I think that they've missed that with O'Neill. It's something that really, you know, O'Neill as a tactician really was quite lacking for a lot of time. There was, the standard 65-minute substitute that was quite prevalent during his time at Aston Villa. And there were just a lot of simplicities in the way that he played football, and he seemed to completely ignore factors like Adam Johnson needing to be further up the pitch because he's not a fast winger, he's a dribbling winger, and just little nuances like that. But I think they'll gain with Di Canio, and you would imagine as a consequence, improved performances.
Di Canio, though, you say that, you know, he's a motivator and might be the kind of guy to get this, to raise this squad's attitude at the moment and going into these final few games of the season, the final seven games. But that was something Martin O'Neill was very much revelled for. He was considered a great motivator of men, even if his tactics maybe weren't as astute as other managers. Are you surprised how he hasn't been able to raise this Sunderland side in kind of crunch games and at crunch times so far this season?
To a degree, I think that's possibly what the tipping point on Saturday was. He touched on it briefly in his press conference and said that, you know, you can't really, negate the fact that Man United have better quality, but you can close down, you can do the simple things and defend. And I think when they stop doing that, you kind of realise that perhaps the sparkle that was Martin O'Neill's motivation had really worn off. And that was, saying that, that's despite, you know, Craig Gardner as recently as the week before describing him as an unbelievable manager and the best in the business. I do think that that was the tipping point, and it's something that they've always had kind of passion at the Stadium of Light, unquestionably. And even as the slide kind of really got into its stride and things started to get a bit scary for them, there was still effort from Sunderland, but too often it was quality and tactics that let them down, and the better organised sides were coming, sitting off, and Sunderland didn't really know how to play that, because that's not how O'Neill played at Villa. It wasn't how he set the side up when he first joined. They were a counter-attacking side that, when the impetus was given to them to lead the game, was normally when they fell apart.
Let's look elsewhere around the table now, Kristen, and have a look at Chelsea. That unbelievable win for Southampton this weekend, winning 2-1 at home against Chelsea. And does Rafa Benitez, do you think, does he prioritise more the FA Cup today and, of course, the UEFA Cup, the Europa League that they're still in, over getting that fourth place spot for Chelsea this season, do you think?
I think that winning a cup is definitely something that, you know, would help him a little bit. By his own admission, he's not there after this season, so you could argue it's going to be like that Michael Douglas movie. Stepping down or something, where he goes a little bit crazy. I can see it being like that in the last few weeks, but the issue he has is deciding possibly what is the most important for the football club. I think for them, getting that Champions League spot is the most important, because it's a revenue generator. A cup is very nice, but it's very rare that domestic cups bring a lot of money, bar the Premier League. And for Chelsea, the financials don't make the prettiest of reading the last few years. And you need to redress that, and a good way to do it is through prize money and through competition money and such like, whether you win it or even just enter it. And the Champions League is a huge cash cow in that sense, because you get money for winning games, you get money for entering, etc., etc. But I can see why he would want to best United. I think he'll try and, in many ways, balance his figurative chips out across as many aspects as he can and keep all three going along nicely. But the difficulty he has is that Manchester United are probably thinking the same way. They don't have the Champions League burden. The Premier League is all but sewn up, so they can kind of focus on the FA Cup and try and achieve that double.
They're obviously playing as we speak right now, Kristen, and you talk about United wanting to achieve that double. What does that do for Alex Ferguson, maybe his time towards the end of this season and possibilities of retirement? Do you see him thinking about sticking around for another year? It's another thing that's just been brought up over the last few weeks about Fergie and how long he has left at Manchester United.
Well, he was supposed to retire a decade ago, but it was the words of the late Sir Bobby Robson that convinced him to stay on, so we can, you know, thank the great man for that, if not nothing else. But the thing with Sir Alex Ferguson is that there is going to be an almighty crater left when he leaves, because of the personality he is, because of what he represents for that club. The thing is, as well, he's only 71, and as I said, with Sir Bobby Robson, he was going still, you know, quite late into his 70s. And I think what you have to remember there is that he still looks, you know, completely compos mentis. He looks as if he could handle it. And I think that for him, he'll know when it's time to go. I think that like a heavyweight boxer, you know when it's time to leave. And I don't see any reason for him to go, you know, for at least the next 2 or 3 years, unless something serious would happen.
This Manchester United side, 25 wins in the first 30 games of the Premier League season. Obviously, there's only 8 left this year for United. But how good is this United side compared to the other sides that Fergie's brought through with this club? Is it one of the best?
It feels it, definitely. I mean, the strike force is definitely up there with the side of 99, just because of its variety. You have a predator in Van Persie, you have someone who's perhaps a Tracatista in Wayne Rooney, you can dip between the two. You've got a poacher in Chicharito, and then you've got, you know, a Solskjaer type runner in Danny Welbeck. So it's an interesting one in that sense. I think defensively there's still one or two issues. That side itself had Jaap Stam there. I don't see that same kind of standout leader at the back of the minute. I think that if Manchester United are truly tested defensively, they can have some issues. Raphael is probably the one that surprised me the most in terms of upping his performance further than you expected. And I think as well the midfield is just up there. I personally think Shinji Kagawa is really flying under the radar at the minute. I watched him on Saturday and I thought he was absolutely brilliant, yet he isn't really garnering the plaudits because he's not finishing things off. It's kind of what you don't see him do is the most impressive facet. And I think that, yeah, maybe next year this side could go and match that treble-winning side. It just needs a little one or two final pieces, I think, to reach those heights.
Does Fergie have to invest in that back four, though? Rumours that Vidic could be going to AC Milan in the summer, and Rio Ferdinand's obviously not getting any younger, and he's got that torrid back problem that keeps him out of international duty these days. So is it at the back four that they have to start investing, even though they've got, you know, Johnny Evans and Smalling and people like that coming through?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they need someone. I mean, Evans and Smalling, they're difficult because you would say that they're young, but they're not that young, if you understand. I mean, they're not teenagers. They've got experience, but you also need a leader in there. And I think that that's perhaps what's missing. I mean, on Saturday, I did think Vidic was going to come off quite early after he, you know, put the ball out and touched his rib. And he is kind of getting a little bit sort of injury prone. There's definitely a certain frailty, if you will, to his body. And I think that's starting to show through. And if he does go, I think it would be a shame for Manchester United. I personally have thought he was always a little bit overrated. I thought that really his strength came from the fact that he was allowed to do the dirty work and had someone as smart and intelligent as Rio Ferdinand to sweep up, a bit like Nesta and Cannavaro in the 2006 World Cup, although Cannavaro was a fantastic defender. And I think, yeah, it's finding that defender, though. I mean, there are a lot of decent candidates. I think maybe, you know, Mats Hummels is probably someone who could really do a job for them, but again, it's whether you can prize him away from Dortmund at the minute. I think it's finding the candidate as well as acknowledging that you need to go out and buy one.
What about now? Let's just look quickly before we let you go, Christian, to the lower part of the table. Of course, the relegation battle still flying around. Aston Villa throwing away that one goal lead. We were talking about that a little earlier in the show. But it's Wigan pulling off the great escape, it seems, once again. We've talked about Sunderland getting dragged into this. Are Wigan going to pull themselves out of this? The momentum that they seem to get at this time of year is just unbelievable.
Yeah, I think the momentum stems from the fact that they're constantly changing themselves in the off-season. If you look, they're always losing somebody. I think the season before it was Charles Nzogbia, this season it was Victor Moses to Chelsea. And I do wonder if perhaps the influx of new faces just takes time to bed in and settle as a team. And thankfully for them, it hits that point just as the season's crescendo. And as a consequence, you see a sharp upturn in their performances. I don't think they planned this, definitely, even though it probably sells them a fair few season reviews in the Wigan club shop. It's something that you would probably give them a mental edge now as well, because teams will be thinking, well, they've done this before. But again, you're only one slip up away from a slide, and I think that's what Wigan will probably have to remember. But the issue is as well that with the relegation battle, there's always one surprise fall, and I say that looking that Norwich and Newcastle are still quite precariously up there in 15th and 14th, and it's something that I could definitely see Sunderland pulling themselves out. I think you can tip Wigan for that same thing, and maybe Villa are that side that go down, because at the minute, it's not just confidence, it's decisions as well. And I think that the Nathan Baker tackle, it was one of those instances where perhaps after the season you look back and think, yeah, it was things like that that sent us down, that naivety of youth.
Yeah, I think we all saw that challenge coming kind of a mile off when Suarez cut onto his back onto his left foot down at the byline, going nowhere, and Baker didn't need to make that challenge at all. You mentioned the surprise ones then. I mean, Southampton, obviously, the two wins and a draw in their last three games have got a bit of momentum, but Stoke are on a very slippery slide as well, and they're in and around the same points tally as Norwich at the moment on 34 points in the Premier League. Do you see Tony Pulis' side getting sucked into it? Because there's been a lot of calls recently for Pulis to go up at Stoke.
Yeah, and I can see why. He's spent well over 100 million in his seasons there, and what real progression has there been? I can't really see any significant one, in, other than perhaps the wage bill and the players that they're paying. I think that, you know, they've got a terrible run in the form table at the minute. I think only Sunderland are below them in that, and the football is quite dour. I was lucky enough to see them quite recently at St James's Park, and the style is very It's simplistic. You could argue in the same way O'Neill's tactics were simplistic. He coaches them within an inch of their life, and as a consequence, it doesn't provide the most attractive football. And I imagine for a Stoke fan, if you're not being entertained and you're losing, what's the point of the manager then? It becomes a redundant situation. And yes, he did very well to get them up there, but again, with the money he's had available to him, I would be looking to perhaps see more of an evolution in the style. There have been slight instances where you think, yeah, this is a side that's probably looking to get a bit more technical, a bit more on the ground, but it's never been consistent enough to think that it's a concerted effort. It was always just serendipity, perhaps. And that's probably the issue. I think that the biggest thing you have to question is, how would someone like, let's say, Roberto Martinez, or even more recently, Mauricio Pochettino, how would they spend that same money across the same period? Because if you say that he's had about 20 million a season, which is a fair breakdown, how would they spend that money? And I think they'd spend that money probably a little bit better.
Do you think, though, a Stoke side with the setup they've got at the moment, if Pulis was to go, would somebody like Martinez want to come in? Somebody that can play that and get that kind of attractive football out of players, knowing the squad that he's going to be inheriting from that Stoke side?
I don't think so. I think, you know, Roberto Martinez turned down Liverpool, so I think that, with all due respect to Stoke, I think he wouldn't see too much of an issue in spurning that offer as well. I think he's looking for the right project, and he's being quite clever in that sense. He's being smart enough to realise that management is a game that can very quickly ruin your reputation if you make the wrong decision, and why destroy what ultimately has been good work at Wigan. There are certain people who say, well, he hasn't achieved a great deal. I still think he's achieved enough. I think, given that he's consistently lost his best players, he's had to find players that perhaps weren't as prevalent. I mean, Aruna Kone was well known in Spain, you know, he was doing great things for Levante, but to single him out and make that effort and think, you know what, yeah, it's that kind of, you have to be 100% sure because you don't have as many shots to take, so you've still got to hit that target. And again, I think the problem he would have is that, yeah, you could say it's the ideal situation. I mean, if he's got Gary Caldwell, no disrespect to him, playing as a ball playing centre back, then surely he could do the same with Ryan Shawcross. I think the issue for him is that whether that's the project he wants. I think perhaps he wants one that has a little bit more growth, and it's whether Stoke's chairman would quite happily just give more money to another manager, having seen what Pulis has done with his first attempts.
Christian, we've kept you far too long on the show today, mate, and obviously there's the Manchester United-Chelsea game that you need to get back to watching too as well. Enjoy studying up on Paolo Di Canio, and remember to look at not only the referee push and the fight with Leon Clark and the salute as well that he did in Italy, but, you know, there are some glorious moments in his career, such as the scissor kick for West Ham, and obviously the goal he scored against AC Milan when he was playing at Napoli as well. But Christian, enjoy looking back at all of that, and good luck following Sunderland with him at the helm for the rest of this season, mate.
I'll leave you with my favourite Di Canio quote. He said of Francesco Totti, if you told Totti there was problems in the Middle East, he'd think a fight had broken out on the right of midfield.
Christian, always a pleasure to have you on, mate. Take care and have a fantastic day.
Thanks.
Cheers, mate. Christian Hennage there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things around the Premier League. Got very good. We're just going all over the place with the Premier League today. Obviously, I had a chat about the Aston Villa-Liverpool game and heard a little bit from Steven Gerrard and from Jamie Carragher on that. We'll be hearing from Brad Guzan a little later on as well in the show. But yeah, it's just weird. The number of sides that you look at that can be getting sucked into this Premier League race, as I say, we spoke about it a little earlier. You look at Sunderland, you look at Norwich, you look at Stoke, Southampton, you know, that big win against Chelsea, and obviously have done exceptionally well this season, but still just not out of it quite yet. 30 points is what you're on if you're in the bottom three, in 18th place, and Aston Villa. Obviously, Queen's Park Rangers and Reading, though, looking like they're done and dusted. Queen's Park Rangers playing tonight against Fulham. We're going to take a very quick break here on the show. When we come back, we're going to be talking all things about the rest of Europe, hearing from Brad Guzan as well on his thoughts a little bit on the US men's national team and travelling to and from Mexico, Denver and the West Midlands. And of course, we'll also be looking ahead to the games this evening. All that and more coming up here on WFD.